see. They never wanted me. The curse is laid upon my race. Useless serpents, they bring disgrace. A man without a face. Time they pass again. It's so hard to tell where and when. Yeah, just do the best you can. The flames will burn away the waste. All the lies that they told erased. A man without face. A man without a 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 face.
Welcome, dear ladies and gentlemen, to the Rabbit Hole Radio Show with your host, David James. Good day, dear people, dear kinsmen and kinswomen. A great hello to you. Hello, hello, hello. Well, here we are on the Rabbit Hole Radio Show, and I want to tell you that yesterday, I was talking about on the Word of the Most High show, which I really do think is a remarkable show, talking about the fruits of the Apostle Paul's gospel. I just think that is amazing, because if you look at the fruits of Christianity today, if you look at the weakness of the Christianity, if you look at how it has been Judaized and all these things, it's all to do with the Apostle Paul's gospel. Not following the law, not following the food laws, not obeying the commandments, and all these things. Well, I talked about a fellow that, a nasty fellow that wrote me under the name Warren Vandersall. Now, I didn't know whose name that was, but somebody informed me of who that is. And in the email, this nasty creature said that this fellow had said he agreed with him about me being the poor man's Wickstrom. This fellow didn't like my music. He didn't like anything. I knew who it was, and I should have known exactly who it was immediately, because he's such a little faggot coward. It's Visser. That's who it is. Visser wrote to me in other people's names, too, under other people's names. He's a little coward. You know, they call him Geronimo, Gerona Larry, and Gerona Curly. You know what I mean? I mean, this guy is just a little wannabe Israelite with a long horse face. And he's out there teaching in the identity circles, and he's not even a white man. Admittedly, he's not a white. He admitted it himself. And it's the same old, same old, same old. This guy, you know, he has done these dastardly things. See, no real Christians do any of this stuff. No real brothers do any of these things that he's doing. You see, that's bearing false witness, right? He once accused me because I had a little fun show and where I did this thing about, what's his name there? Charlie Chan hosted Saxon's Creed, and I wrote all these different Charlie Chan type sayings and had a little fun with it. And he accused me of bearing false witness. And here he is writing in the name of Ray Bunzo one time, and now writing in, I'm not going to say who Vandersall is. I didn't even know, because I'm not interested in identity. Identity is lopped up with agents and people like Visser. Jews, agents, and people like Visser. The guy is inept. He's a beast of the field. He's not a white man. I just think it's just amusing that this world is so whacked out. I mean, just so whacked out. Who would even entertain listening to anything from this fellow after all the dastardly things he's done over the last decade? After I had wrote about him and this and that and exposed him somewhat, he closed down his ministry for 6 months. And then he came back 6 months later. But he has no ministry because he's not a white man. You see, it's just, so this is the kind of people that, excuse me, these are the kind of people that ruin the name of Christian identity. This is why I want nothing to do with it. Nobody wants to be in anything where there's all agents and all liars and all this stuff. Nobody needs this stuff. Who needs that? I don't need it. I just follow the Father. I told you, I've encouraged all of you to follow the Father. Don't follow men. Don't follow institutions. Follow the Father. And that's still my recommendation. And it's a good recommendation, obviously, isn't it? So, I think we'll go into our Maurice Pinet book. We've been learning some very interesting things in this book. And until it stops, you know, I'm going to continue in it. So, right here it says, concerning, we're on page, in case you want to follow along, page 230. I'll wait a minute. I'll take a sip of my coffee, and you can get to page 230 of Maurice Pinet's The Plot Against the Church. And this is from 1962. And it's a Catholic thing, as you well know, unless you're new today or something. You will know that I'm anti-Catholic. Not anti-Catholic, the people that are going to the church. Anti-Catholic, the organization, the what it is. It's a false version of Christianity. And it has been a false version of Christianity since day one. Concerning this struggle, the Israel, he says Israelite, but he means the Jewish historian Gretz, to whom we will hand over at this point, reports, he says, this is Gretz speaking, on Saturdays and the Jewish festivals, many Christians, especially of the female sex, both women of noble birth as well as those of lowly status, were regularly to be encountered in the synagogues. I hope you're listening. They listened devoutly to the trumpet call on the day of the Jewish New Year, were at the solemn cult of the Day of Atonement, and took part in the celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles, which is an Israelite feast, but they pretend to follow these things. The fact that they performed all this behind the back of the Christian clergy, and therefore had to beg their neighbors not to betray them, made the matter still more attractive. Against this spontaneous honoring by Christians of Jewish institutions, Chrysostom directed his violent monkish sermons and used all kinds of harsh expressions against them. By his preaching that the synagogues were disgraceful exhibitions, dens of thieves, and even worse. Here it is. See, again, they're glorifying men. This great father, Now, we know that Jesus Christ said, call no man on earth your father. But they just do whatever they want anyway, because Paul taught them to do that. Remember I told you, Paul said that we are his begotten? He said, though you have 10,000 instructors in Christ, teachers in Christ, yet ye have not many fathers. And he claimed to be our father. And this is first, I believe it's 1 Corinthians 4. He claimed we are his begotten. See? So this is where the Catholics got all this from, you see? And this is what I'm talking about, the fruits of the Apostle Paul. This great father of the church, they say, undoubtedly expressed great truths. In fact, he had uttered them in our days when he would have been, had he uttered them in our days, he would have been condemned as an anti-Jewite by the Jews, as well as by the Christian clergy who play into the latter's hands. On the other hand, one sees from this how widespread, even in Rome, the core of Christians who was outwardly appeared Christian, or was who outwardly appeared as Christian, but in secret practiced the Jewish cult. The Jew Gretz describes to us how these kinds of Christians attended the synagogues behind the back of the Catholic clergy, and how they were concerned that their neighbors did not betray them. If they noticed this most suspicious activity, it is therefore natural that the great father of the church, the great father of the church, it's not glorifying the Father in heaven, it's not glorifying Jesus Christ, it's glorifying the church, it's glorifying the men of the church, and glorifying Mother Mary, who is the goddess, Diana, Isis, whatever you want to call her. So this fellow, Christendom, thundered against these false Christians, or the church had still not created the institution for their combating and prosecution, namely the Holy Office of the Inquisition. Saint Ambrose, Bishop of Milan, one of the great saints and illustrious church fathers. Are you listening? See, I'm proving to you what I'm saying to you. All I got to do is read this book, and it proves it to you. So, the Bishop of Milan, one of the greatest saints and illustrious church fathers, who exercised such a decisive influence upon the emperors Gratian and Theodosius I, and to whom belongs thanks for the final triumph of the church in the Roman Empire, was at that time the most restless and most energetic fighter against the synagogue of Satan. Upon different occasions, he condemned the Jews and attempted to prevent them from gaining control of the Roman Empire. You see, he defined who they are. You see, the synagogue of Satan. And then he says, the Jews. See, that he's, we knew that already, but he's telling you that. It was also his heart's wish to prevent them from being successful in destroying the church. Above all, when the usurper Maximus temporarily revealed himself to be lord of half the empire, as Saint Ambrose himself provides evidence, Maximus was a Jew and had attaining his crowning as emperor of Rome by murdering the devout Catholic Gratian. Okay. Now you're hearing some history, ladies and gentlemen. We not only have Nero, whose wife, really his mistress, was a Jewess. She became a Jew, and the rabbis were using her to try to control the Roman Empire. Now, we had said that, well, the Apostle Paul can't be a Jew because no Jew could be a citizen of Rome. But we see right here that there's a fellow here that is a Jew that has claimed to be the Lord of half the empire. And then we had the Jew lover, Julian, remember, from this book? So there's funny business going on here. It may not be so true that you couldn't be a Jew and a citizen of the Roman Empire, because the Jews had synagogues there. And the Jews were favored there, obviously. So who knows how true that is, that if you couldn't be a citizen of Rome. I had been somebody that had talked about that several times. But this does not add up. Listen carefully once more, if you would be so kind. Maximus was a Jew and had attained his crowning as emperor of Rome by murdering the devout Catholic Gratian. As was to be expected, Maximus supported anew the Jews and pagans who gathered around him. However, he was fortunately defeated by Theodosius in the year 378, as a result of which the hope of the Jews of this time gaining control of the Imperium of the Caesars vanished. So, is it not interesting that we had three Jewish popes in the Middle Ages after the year 1000? And is it not interesting that we've seen that they have gotten their hands very close to the top of the Roman Empire, and as well as to the top, right here, with Maximus. And remember Julian, who favored them greatly and was going to build. I thought that was the most amazing thing about this book so far, was he was going to rebuild the temple for them, and the men that started to try to rebuild it got burned by fire, and they had to stop. So, in order to form an idea of the anti-Jewish zeal and Catholic saintliness that formed the quintessence of the St. Ambrose, we will again follow Gretz, or allow him, to the official and classical historian of Jewry, who is a Jew, who enjoys so much prestige and authority with the Jews, to speak. With dismay, he confirms. Ambrose of Milan was a violent official who, this is Gretz speaking, by the way. Ambrose of Milan was a violent official who had not the slightest inkling of theology, particularly for this reason, because he was notorious within the church as violent. He was elevated to the rank of bishop. On a certain occasion, when the Christians of Rome had set on fire a synagogue and the usurper Maximus had ordered that the Senate should rebuild it at state expense, Ambrose called him a Jew. When the bishop of Callinicus, I got it, in North Mesopotamia, had caused a synagogue there to be burnt by monks, Theodosius commanded that it should be erected at his expense and punished those who had participated in this deed. This was 388 A.D. Ambrose broke out into a violent rage over this, and in the letter he sent to the emperor upon the occasion, used the harshest and most provocative turns of phrase, so that the monarch saw himself obliged to rescind the command. Ambrose accused the Jews of disregarding and deriding the Roman laws. In connection with this, he abused them by saying that they might not provide either emperors or governors from their ranks, that they were refused admittance to the army or senate, and they did not even possess the right to sit at a table with nobility. The Jews were thus only there to pay high taxes. Now that's what it's all about, ladies and gentlemen. That's what it's all about. You see, if they weren't in our Senate right now, and if they weren't in our Army or Navy or any of these other things, and if they weren't in all the other positions they shouldn't be in, the medical industry, pharmaceutical industry, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we wouldn't be in the shape we're in right now. Apart from other extremely interesting things, the outstanding Jew, Gretz, tells us something which awakens our main interest, namely that St. Ambrose, on account of his reputation for being violent, was elevated to the dignity of bishop. Gretz himself confirms his violence with details which prove his energy in combating Jewry, as we will later expressly prove. So you see, ladies and gentlemen, again, they want you to, people like myself and everybody else, to say, oh, we're not violent. We don't ascribe to violence. We want peaceful protests. You see, that's how they keep us in line. The only way anything gets done is through violence. I'm sorry I have to tell you that, but that's the way it is. If that's not true, then why must we bring people back into the Stone Age through violence to give them democracy for the Jews? You know, war. Why do the Jews have Antifa out there? Because everything that has to be done through violence. You just can't do it peacefully because nothing gets done. Look at this fellow here and understand that he was violent. And that's how things got done against Jewry. Sorry, but that's the way it is. Now, I'm not trying to organize any violence, but I'm trying to make you understand that nothing gets done without violence. The Jews use violence to get their things done. They just don't want you to. One fella going out and doing a violent act is not going to do anything. So that's a waste of time. So, as we will later expressly prove, the honorary offices of the church during the times of the apogee of the church, as with those the times of St. Ambrose, were entrusted to those who defended the church most zealously and energetically, especially against its principal enemy, Jewry. This gives an exact explanation for the glorious period of Catholicism in such times. See, we're always glorifying the Catholic Church, always glorifying the church fathers. We're always glorifying Mother Mary the goddess, which isn't Mary at all. A combative hierarchy, which it is conscious of the enemy on the other side, guarantees the possibility of triumph, whilst a largely non-combative hierarchy, which does not recognize the true danger, coincides exactly with the epochs of weakness and decline of the church. The epochs of St. Athanasius and Arianist triumphs coincide with the unmistakable fact that the honorary church offices were brought by indifferent representatives, and even by members of the fifth column. The true defenders of the church were at the time pressed to the wall, disregarded and even persecuted. So it occurred with Athanasius, the great father of the church, there it is again, glorifying men, and with all the bishops and clergy who followed him. The same occurs in many places in our time. A great number of clergy and religious dignitaries who have stood out through their adherence to Christ and their energy in the defense of the Holy Church see themselves humiliated and even persecuted through other clerics who provide communism and Freemasonry with every assistance. Those clergy who serve the interests of Jewry strive to purchase the offices of bishops and cardinals when they become vacant, in identical manner as their predecessors in the time, as did their predecessors in the time of Arius, the Jew, who brought the Aryan conspiracy. This concealed maneuver has made possible the Freemasonic and communist triumphs, so that it already seems as if no one can any longer stop them. By means of these deceptive tactics of slandering the good and pressing them to the wall in order to purchase the honorary church offices for the wicked, which fortunately has not been successful in many places, although in others far more so, the fifth column has been able to bring under its control in recent years many positions, which in fact form a minority within the clergy of the church. Now let me say what that is. It's a secret society within a secret society, or a church within the church, a fifth column. But have a decisive influence, he says. They form the principal cause why in some lands a more or less considerable part of the Catholic clergy has promoted the revolutionary Freemasonic or communist movements. As a result, the defense of Catholic governments has been completely crippled, or at least good patriots frustrated, by being robbed of the support of great sectors of Catholicism and being unconsciously driven into the Freemasonic or communist revolts. Remember, this is a Hegelian dialectic, and though these two fought against each other for a while, they now are in complete synthesis with one another. You can see that, plain and clear. The most recent case of Cuba, now remember, this is 1962, this book came out. The most recent case of Cuba in America speaks volumes in this respect and should be for all the occasion of a deep-reaching study and investigation, since it represents a typical example. The communist and persecutor of the church, Fidel Castro, who is a Jew, by the way, was a Jew, was, when he was about to suffer shipwreck, protected by Catholic bishops. In his revolutionary movement, was supported by the clerics and bishops with enthusiasm and zeal, which would have been worthy of a better cause. It was this circumstance that in the first place motivated the deeply Orthodox Cuban people to commit itself unreservedly to the cause of the communist leader. Thus, the latter carried off a triumph whose desolating result we all know. This is what Bernie wants to be in America. Bernie wants to be just like his fellow Jew, Fidel Castro. It is understandable that St. Ambrose, Bishop of Milan, and a great church leader in his time, was dismayed that Theodosius allowed the Jews to overstep the laws of Rome, which blocked admission for them to the Senate, as well as allowing them no admittance to the army and to the government positions, for he was conscious of a great harm which they could cause Christianity and the empire if they gained control of the government. A further important fact must be mentioned. The Jews were the initiators and propagandists of the Arian heresy. I hope you're listening now, because Arius is a Jew, was a Jew. So listen again. The Jews were the initiators and propagandists of the Arian heresy, to which sect many Germanic barbarians from the frontier regions also belonged, of whom the majority, which was an open secret, were inspired by the wish to attack and conquer the Roman Empire. If St. John Chrysostom had lived in our times, then undoubtedly the Jews and their satellites within Christianity would have thrown against them the accusation of being Nazis and disciples of Hitler, just as they do the same with all zealous Catholics who at present wish to protect the church from the Jewish threat. The Jew Gretz says, as we have already quoted elsewhere, in reference to the role which both played in that period of open struggle of the church against the Jews. He said, the chief fanatics against the Jews in that time were John Chrysostom of Antioch and Ambrose of Milan, who attacked the Jews with most extreme violence. See, that's the only way to get anything done, you understand? See, I can't help that that's the only way that he gets things done. That's just the way it is. Naturally, before Holy Church was able to carry through its final triumph over the synagogue of Satan and Arianism, it had to withstand such critical moments as in our days. We are given vivid details of this in the letter, which was signed by 33 of the most well-known bishops. How many bishops? 33. Among these are found the first president of the Ecumenical Council of Constantinople, St. Meletius of Antioch, the great church father, another great church father. St. Gregory Nazianzen, who presided over the said ecumenical council after the death of Meletius. St. Basil, likewise father of the church, and other outstanding personages through their reputation and their holiness. From this letter, we quote word for word the following paragraph. Listening, ready? The dogmas of religion are distorted, and the laws of the church are turned upside down. The ambition of those who do not fear Yahweh reaches out for the honorary, I put Yahweh instead of the Lord, okay? The ambition of those who do not fear Yahweh reaches out for the honorary offices of the church, and the office of bishop is offered as a prize for the most subtle infamy, and in fact, with such craft that he who utters the gravest blasphemies is held to be the most capable of all for leading the people as a bishop. The seriousness of the bishop's office has been lost. There is a lack of shepherds who conscientiously guard the flock of Yahweh. The property of the poor is permanently used by the ambitious for their own advantage and used for gifts to aliens. The true following of the canon has come into forgetfulness. Concerning all this, the unbelievers laugh, and those weak in the faith hesitate. The faith itself has become doubted. Uncertainty has poured itself over souls. For those who mocked the word of God in their maliciousness reflect the true state of affairs, and the voice of the devout is silent. What finds expression of the aforementioned bishops in this memorable letter can in fact be applied to what occurs at present in some dioceses, even if fortunately not in all. However, there are dioceses, above all which the fifth column predominates, in which the Semitophilic prelates are at work in perceptible alliance with Freemasonry and Communism to secure themselves in boldest manner the bishop's office, exactly as saints quoted reveal. They interfere in the internal affairs of other dioceses in which devout bishops officiate, and only wait their death in order to stretch out their feelers in Rome. By means of deceptive maneuvers and misrepresentations, they strive to buy the successors of the vacant diocese, and in fact not only for the most capable, but for the accomplices of the fifth column. In such a way, they trample upon the right of those who, on grounds of their virtue and services, should occupy bishops' chairs. Yes, this is the way it is, gradualism. This has always been a tool of the devil and his offspring. The Stooges spelled it out for you. Slowly I turned, inch by inch, step by step. Very interesting, isn't it? It says, but in that epoch, these saints, who have now been canonized by the church, managed to save the situation. If they also, on their side, revealed unnecessary caution and hesitancy, then they nevertheless resolutely opposed the powers of evil and unmasked them publicly. They also pilloried all evil conditions, as we clearly recognize by means of the letter quoted, because as these saintly church fathers say, the silence of the good makes possible the victory of evil. Let me read that again. The silence of the good makes the makes possible the victory of evil. Right, Andrew? As a result of such clear as well as energetic conduct, the church was able to carry off the triumph over Jewry, paganism, Arianism, and other heresies. However, the saints who saved Catholicism, see, it's Catholicism they saved. It wasn't Christianity. It wasn't the gospel of Christ. It wasn't anything. It was Catholicism they saved. You see? See, this is the problem. The saints who saved Catholicism in different times had to pass along a painful path of suffering. And if, in fact, not only from the side of Jewry, against which they fought with such resolution, but also from the side of those within the clergy, who consciously or unconsciously served the interests of the Jews. We have already seen that Saint Athanasius was persecuted by the bishops, adhering to the heresy of the Jew Arius, as also by the emperors standing under the heretical influence. Even two church councils did not call a halt to this, but these that had actually been summoned for the salvation of Catholicism. The salvation of Catholicism, you see? I just want you to keep understanding what, see, we're reading a book, but we're also learning a lot about the Catholic self-praise. You wonder why they've fallen so hard? After pride comes a fall. After you exalt yourself, you will be humbled. So, very interesting, right? So even the two church councils did not call a halt to this, but these had actually been summoned for the salvation of Catholicism, transformed themselves once they were controlled by the Arians, and turned against the orthodoxy into veritable heretical councils. And in order to complete the picture, which shows how those saints had to suffer, who, like Saint Chrysostom, opposed Jewry and heresy with energy and resolution, we take over literally what the biographers of the saints mentioned say. As sources, we quote Chrysostom himself, as well as the Catholic historian John Cassian, Martyrius, and others. What is most astonishing and incomprehensible for us, as for John Cassian and the obscure eulogist of the 7th century, Martyrius, is that he, St. John Chrysostom, was not banished or finally condemned to death by a governor of Decius or Diocletian, but by a band of ambitious and ill-willed bishops. On the other side, there were bishops who, while whispering to the weak Arcadius and the raving Eudoxia that John was guilty of insulting their majesty, which meant nothing less than demanding his head, protested that they could not intervene and that the emperor would in fact know what was to be done in such a case, for which naturally no small punishment existed. You see, this is again what these Jews do. They slander. Over and over we've seen in this book and in many cases and studies that we've gone through recently that Jews use slander. They'll go to a leader and say, he doesn't respect your kingship, he thinks you're this or that, and they'll make up all sorts of things, and pretty soon their head is rolling, and the Jew is laughing, and the king was used as a pawn by a Jew. or the Roman government, as we saw earlier in this book, how they go to the Roman government and they make accusations, and then it causes all kinds of persecution to the Christians. See, this is just what Jewry does. Jewry is a filthy thing. It's a filthy, diabolical, filthy, rotten, murderous thing. So, let's continue here. And why should one not recall the terrible scenes at Caesarea in Cappadocia, when the saint, coming from distant Cocusus, trod the soil there, tired and exhausted and delirious with high fever? He was almost torn to pieces by a horde, as he called them himself, of wild monks who were incited by the bishop. And what was worse, they belonged to the protective troop which should have accompanied the poor banished saint. And while the people wept as a result, showed that it was better that its shepherds, the envy of the local bishop, mercilessly pursued the outlawed saint into his refuge, where the magnanimous neighborly love of a noble woman granted him a roof. And they compelled him to continue his march on the night without moonlight over treacherous mountain paths. These were the men who made Christianity great. Really? Who allowed the Holy Church to triumph and save them from the cunning of their outer and inner foes. At present time, the same type of Catholics, clergy and laymen, are needed in order to save Christianity and the whole of mankind, who are threatened by communism, Freemasonry, and the synagogue of Satan, which has instigated the whole conspiracy. It's amazing, ladies and gentlemen. Communism, Freemasonry, and the synagogue of Satan all have everything to do with communism, Freemasonry, and the synagogue of Satan. You see, they're all intertwined. And the head of that beast, of course, is the synagogue of Satan, the Jews. The Antichrists, I call them. I entitled that show from this book, Julian, the Lover, Emperor Julian, the Lover of the Antichrists. I like that title. It sounds nice. And it's very apropos. The high dignitaries of the church and the worldly political leaders who fight for the salvation of Catholicism under such difficult conditions must be prepared to suffer not only all kinds of attacks from the side of revolutionary forces of Jewry, but also from the side of the descendants of Judas Iscariot. Huh? They're one and the same. The latter play within the clergy in this or that form of cards of forces of Satan, and it is they who, through their high and arrogantly usurped struggle within the Holy Church, can instigate the most violent, destructive, and painful attacks against those who fight for the defense of a Catholicism. I hope you're listening. Hope you're reading between the lines. And their gravely threatened nations. He says, may the Lord God, I'm just going to say, may God provide faith, resolution, and strength to them who, in imitation of Christ, take up the cross in order to follow him in this decisive hour for the fate of the world. Chapter 8. Saint Cyril of Alexandria conquers Nestor and expels the Jews. Another Jewish expulsion. Amazing, huh? After the death of Theodosius I and his sons Honorius, or his sons, Honorius and Arcadius, inherited the throne of the already divided empire, the first in the west and the second in the east. Their policy towards the Jewish enemies was weak, since they completely disregarded the norms of an energetic struggle, such as had been preached by St. John Chrysostom and by St. Ambrose. In addition, Arcadius in the east surrounded himself with corrupt advisors, in other words, Jews, who sold their protection to the Jews, Rufinius and Eutropius, who, according to the Jew Gretz, showed the Jews most extreme favor. Rufinius was avaricious, and the Jews had already discovered the magic power of gold in order to thaw out the most hardened hearts. As a result, various laws favoring the Jews were announced. This sounds like America. Among these laws is found that which had already been put in force again through Constantius and confirmed, concerning which Gretz asserts, the patriarchs and likewise all synagogue servants were placed equal to the Christian clergy by their being freed from the heavy burden of the magistracy. What the renowned Jewish historian stresses here is in fact of the highest importance, for it shows that the Jews had already discovered the power of gold in order to bribe the Christian and pagan leaders. In reality, they had already found this out much earlier, as an example of the Jew Simon the magician proves, who even wished to bribe St. Peter, or that of the Jewish superintendents? No, St. Peter's not Jewish. Who were successful in buying one of the 12 apostles that he may betray Jesus. In the course of history, the Jews have systematically used the power of gold in order to buy political and religious leaders. No, that can't be true. Can it? I like playing stupid like that, you know. That's exactly what's going on with the political leaders around the world today. They're buying everybody off. The funny thing is they're laughing because they're buying them off with money that's not real money. Isn't that amazing? Can you imagine the shame of these people when they go before the Father in heaven and he tells them that they sold their souls for fake money? And can you imagine their reaction where they're going to land with the children of the flame? In reality, yeah, they had found this out much earlier. Remember that this Simon the magician wanted to buy the gift of the Holy Ghost, or he wanted to be made an apostle, thus giving him this gift. So he wanted to buy it. In the course of history, the Jews have systematically used the power of gold in order to buy political and religious leaders and to maintain a policy favorable to Jewry. The successors of Judas Iscariot have caused the church and mankind grave harm by means of this method, and they are to a great part guilty of the misfortune which stands before our door. The protection in the east and the tolerance in the west allowed the Jews to collect sufficient strength, which was extremely dangerous. If one takes into consideration that they were sworn enemies of the church and of the empire, even in our times, Jewish evidence has been handed down to us, which provides us with the information about the hatred that the Jews fostered against ancient Rome. And you see, nothing has changed. Just say the Jews fostered against America, or the Jews fostered against Germany, or the Jews fostered against the UK, etc., etc., etc. You understand what I'm saying? See, nothing's changed. It's the same modus operandi. It's the same old song and dance, ladies and gentlemen. In the east of the empire, Theodosius II, the successor of Arcadius, was attentive to the danger at the correct time and seized upon the series of measures in order to counteract them and to ward off Jewish danger in a resolute manner. However, the Jewish historians always record these defensive measures of the Christian states as persecutions, which were unleashed through the fanaticism and the anti-Jewish tendency of the Catholic clergy. The Jew Gretz speaks about these events as follows. Listen carefully, folks. The Middle Ages began for Jewry with Theodosius II, 408 to 450, a very talented emperor, but guided by monks, and whose weakness granted freedom from punishment to the fanatic zeal of some bishops and fostered cruelty. Edicts of this emperor forbade the Jews to build new synagogues, to celebrate on Thursdays the synagogue service communally for Jews and Christians, and to keep Christian slaves. In addition, they contained some other bans of lesser importance. Under this emperor, the patriarchy finally fell. The patriarchy was an institution which for a long time performed the representation of Jewry in the Roman Empire and in many other places. It had its seat in Jerusalem. What this filthy, dirty Jew Gretz does not mention is the reason the Catholic clergy had for reacting in such violent manner against the Jews. As in all cases, so here also, the Jewish historians give information concerning the measures that the church or the Catholic monarchs entered upon against them. However, they never mention the occasions the Jews gave to provoke these reactions. It's just the same today. See, the anti-Jewishism is caused by Jews being in our nations, in our countries. But the Jews want to say, oh, no, that it's not caused by us Jews. It's caused by these haters that are anti-Jewistic. They're the cause of this. Nothing. I mean, this is just ridiculous nonsense. And nothing changes. It's the same thing over and over. Exactly what you're seeing here is the same thing going on today. Why does mankind never learn? The answer to that is because mankind has been encouraged not to pay attention to history. Just as the Apostle Paul's gospel says, don't pay attention to the older part of the Testament, which is history. You know how many answers are in the older part of the Testament to what's going on today and everything that's happening and things that happened back then that are happening again and again now that we're repeating? History is one of the most important subjects that one could study because it will show you the patterns of the enemy. It'll show you the methods of the enemy, the modus operandi, all the same thing. And that's exactly what the enemy does not want you to know, because they want to keep playing this thing on you again and again and again and again, because it works. If you knew about it and didn't and recognized it was being played on you, you would say, oh, we aren't going for that. Sorry, that's over with. But since you don't know about it and you don't want to know about it, you succumb to it. You see? And that's what happens, ladies and gentlemen. The Apostle Paul wanted to make sure that you don't need to look into the older part of the Testament. You just keep your eyes on the Apostle Paul's gospel, his false gospel, that has brought many, many bad fruits into the Father's vineyard. See, the Father is going to gather all the fruits of his vineyard and make wine. But he's not going to use faulty grapes. He's not going to use corrupted grapes. It will destroy the pure wine. You better make note of what I'm saying. So, if we continue here. In the struggle of the church against Jewry of that time, one must mention the decisive appearance of Saint Cyril of Alexandria. He was the leading spirit in the defense of Catholicism again. Yeah, against the new heresy, which was led by Nestor, and which was on the point of dividing the church in exactly the same way as the Arian heresy had done. You see, it's being repeated again, ladies and gentlemen. I didn't even read that till just now. So you see what I'm saying to you? Saint Cyril, the Patriarch of Alexandria, plays at these moments the same role against Nestorianism which previously the great church father Athanasius had taken up in the struggle against Arianism. Like the latter, Saint Cyril applied himself actively to the defense against Jewry by his condemning the Jews upon different occasions and combating all their false machinations. Machination. Now, listen. We see that there is a battle of the Jews, the serpent seed line, against the Arian men. Even though they're the members of the Catholic Church and it's a false church, there's still a battle between the two seed lines, you see? This is just another example of the battles that was started in the garden, which is why the Apostle Paul doesn't want you in the older part of the Testament. He wants to make sure you never find out about the serpent seed line to whom he belongs, so that you will never know that there's a war between the two. Yet we see it over and over right here, don't we? We certainly do. The heresy of Nestor divided the episcopate, since various bishops made common cause with the heretical patriarchs. After a long, drawn-out struggle, however, Saint Cyril was successful in obtaining the condemnation of Nestor from His Holiness to the Holiness the Pope. Another, there it is, we're glorifying the men again, you see. At the Third Ecumenical Council, which took place later at Ephesus, the heretical bishops were fully defeated and Catholicism triumphed. The spirit of the council in question was naturally Saint Cyril of Alexandria, who had to fight further against the remnants of the heresy until he could destroy them. Well, I wonder if he'll define this heresy. I do have a book on the heresies that I have already read from some of it for you, and I suppose I'll have to go through that so we can define these heresies. I had one brother wanted me to tell him what the Arian conspiracy is, and we saw this in Fritz Springmeier's book, we saw this in this book, and we've seen this talked about also in William G. Finley's presentations. It's hard to get a defined, a definition of this heresy. So what I need to do is I'll put a show together at some point. You know, I'll just, we'll read some things and try to figure out what this heresy really is. Now, from my understanding, the Arian heresy was that Jesus Christ is not God, which is Antichrist, right? Because, oh, yeah, we saw this in Fritz Springmeier's book with, actually, it wasn't the Be Wise as Serpents book as much as it was the Watchtower and the Masons. Because this Arian conspiracy came from Scotland. It was promoted in Scotland as well. And Charles Taze Russell himself denied Christianity, if you remember carefully. He denied the deity of Jesus Christ, and he bowed his knee to the unknown God. I told that to the Jehovah Witnesses. I said that Charles Taze Russell denied the deity of Jesus Christ, and that is the truth. And he said, that's not true. I said, oh, it certainly is true. See, Jesus Christ is a good prophet. He's not God, though. See, that's mainly what I believe the Arian conspiracy is, and that's what Arius the Jew was promoting. But it also had something to do with the Trinity, which I'll just explain to you something very quickly. I'm going to talk about this on the next Word of the Most High anyway, but this was the one I was trying to bring up on the last Word of the Most High that the brother had sent me. It's Matthew 28:19, and it says, go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost. Now, a little problem with this, because when this gospel was put out, that did not exist at that time. Tertullian, see, I'm trying to put this together. It was really promoted in the 4th century, and Tertullian was the one that defended this thing, but they say that this also has to do with the Arian conspiracy, the Trinity doctrine. Now, I'm somebody that needs to clarify these things, and we will things as time goes by. I can't do everything. But you see, what's funny is that this doctrine wasn't even alive at the time of the Matthew's gospel, so somebody put it in there after. You see? And of course, they put, go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. Anyway, very interesting. Another show that is, we've learned some things in history here, obviously. And we will stop right here on page 239. All right, that's where we'll start from next time. So, very interesting, is it not? There's been many heresies and many heretics, and not all of the heretics were really heretics. If they didn't concur with what the Catholic Church wanted or what the Apostle Paul wanted, they were deemed heretics. Just like many people that are called troublemakers of the nation or terrorists today are not terrorists. One man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, right? See, a terrorist is whoever they say it is. So if you don't agree with them, you're a terrorist. But that doesn't really mean you're a terrorist. That just means they say you are. And that's it. It's just that simple. You know, at the end of the Rabbit Hole Radio Show, I always give a good piece of advice. Would you like to say it with me? Don't go down the wrong hole. Tell where and when.
Yeah, just do the best you can. The flames will burn away the waste, all the lines that they told erased. A man without